So, any burning questions? Or I told you last week, remember, I'm completely undaunted by silly questions. Fine. And I know what I'm saying, because people are so embarrassed to ask questions in this country.
If you're saying you have no self, where does that leave us with regard to having self-esteem? Because people who have no self-esteem, they themselves are open to abuse of all sorts, terrible depressions. And
that's right.
Illness.
Good question. If you say you have no self, where does that leave us with self-esteem and people abusing that, you know, just being abusive and doing all sorts of horrible things?
And being abused.
And being abused, yeah, yeah. Well, this is why the Buddhist path is not a path of beliefs. The Buddha doesn't say, of course, he says from his own realization, there is no self. But he doesn't ask you to believe him. He says, realize what is what you think self is. What is it? It's an illusion. But you were not going to say that to a teenager who is abusive and whatever. You have to say, that's why the second aspect of the Buddhist teaching is that you don't taught a person unless she or he asks you about this question. Because when that person is interested, then it means that they are maybe ready to hear. You know, and this is an often a question that's being posed quite often. You know, if there is no self, then what do we do, kind of thing. Self-esteem doesn't come from believing in self. Self-esteem comes from a life that is well-lived. And when a life is well-lived, when a life is lived with a sense of integrity, a sense of honesty, a sense of truthfulness, a sense of, acting out kindly, generously, that's how self-esteem builds up. And self-esteem also builds up when you understand yourself better and you accept all the bits of yourself that you normally dislike intensely. You know, the more you understand that all these thoughts are just thoughts, feelings are just feelings, moods are just moods, then you start finding a place in yourself which is not dependent on all this circus in oneself that is so undependable and so, so kind of fragile. That's what sense of lack of self-esteem comes from, being identified with a sense of, you know, with this fragile self which is there. Because it is undependable. And the more you're mindful, the more your awareness, mindfulness increases, the more you are in contact with a sense of solidity there. A sense, you know, you don't know it's not solid nor not solid. It's a sense of confidence. That you're not. Sense of confidence and self-esteem come is also the result of freeing oneself from fear. Yeah, when you're not so frightened, then you can really let confidence come through. Yeah, through, you know, and the understanding is something that arises in your, you know, through the meditation practice, which is not necessarily a formal meditation practice, but it's the ability to sustain and maintain mindfulness throughout every moment of the day, or at least the moment you can maintain it, you know. Maybe not to be too ambitious, you know, but the bit that you can be mindful, then it's, you know, these are precious moments. Because this is that place of refuge, where we talk the refuge. And when everything is chaotic, you can still kind of observe the chaos around you. And you know, if you picked up one thing, you'll be whoop, you know, you'll be wheeled around with everything. And at some point you can be well around with everything and still be centered, you know. Yeah? Because you don't expect not being well around. It's okay. Sometimes we are well around, you know. Okay? Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the differences between lay practice and monastic practice, and if you know of anyone or have known of any lay practitioners who've had insight comparable to monastic people.
I see you coming, we say in French. It means, of course, I mean, the Buddhist teaching is riddled with lay people having attained sotapanna, you know, the first stage of purification, or, you know, so it's not that, it's not close to the, attainment of insight is not close to lay people. The Buddha just pointed to the fact that lay life is dusty. And I think many people have written to me, yes, sister, you're right, lay life is dusty. You're right, Buddha was right. Basically, it means there's lots going on, a lot of things are just being left there on the shelves, not being really addressed or, cleared or just accumulate in our mind a lot. It's more complex. Lay life is more complex. Yeah? I'll answer your question?
Well, it was more... I mean, I'm aware it's talked about in the sutras. I was perhaps asking more about your personal experience of personal acquaintances. I mean, you read that, but then when you're actually living as a lay person, you doubt whether that's really possible.
Well, the doubt is a problem. If you didn't have any doubt, you'd be fine. we had this question going on and on in the early years of our community here. You had the lay people always felt kind of diminished by the very fact that they could not become monks and nuns. So there was always a sense of, we are not as good as you. And then, human beings are human beings, so they will resent the fact that they were not as good as us, some of them. And maybe not openly in front of us, of course, but there was a sense of, there was a kind of sense of great difference between the two groups. And even in America, when I used to teach there, there was a sense that the lay Buddhist and the Buddhist monastics, there was always this feeling that we are as good as you, We are as good as the monastics. This is silly questions, But it was very much a problem. For example, in England, now, this has been overcome. And I think in the States as well, with the whole Vipassana kind of a movement, of lay people. It's been, at some point overcome. People just, work with their doubts, and eventually they just start practicing as it is. You stop wondering, am I as good as, maybe I should be a nun, I don't know, maybe I should be, if I'm not a nun, that's called agitation, being perplexed or... So, for you, in terms of, if I thought I'd been, I could practice in lay life, I would not be a nun, for sure. So if you ask me as a nun, anyway, I've told you a little bit about myself, I think this is just right for me, and the life is eccentric enough to fit me perfectly. For Western women, I mean, it's an unusual lifestyle. And I say this, I don't feel like this anymore, but when I started, I said, this is just up my street, absolutely, this is mad, absolutely mad. Let's get on with it, it's great. living with monks, living with monks, living in a haunted looking house, in the middle of the countryside. I was a kind of cosmopolitan person, in the cove with all these funny rituals and stuff like that, all this kind of chanting and bowing and having to Anjali the monks, when I was a dependent, confident woman. And I thought, this is really crazy, This is bizarre. But I love the Dhamma. I love, I was there to train in my meditation, basically. Because I had trained myself very strongly as a dancer. So I knew what training was about in that field. And then I met Ajahn Sumedho. I was already interested a bit in meditation. And I realized a training is a training. You don't do it for a day or two or a year. I did think like that. I thought to myself, well, if I just be a nun for 2 or 3 months after that, I'll be fixed for the rest of my life. I did think like that, you know, because 10-day retreat had made such a difference for me. I thought 3 months will be, I'll be fixed for the rest of my life. And of course, after 3 months, I was completely hooked, you know, not hooked on monasticism at all, but hooked on the path, you know. So this is it. This is, you know, I want to continue to deepen that understanding of the mind, you know. So that was really what kept me as a nun. And since then, of course, I've been met a lot of people who live a lay life and teach a lot of people who live in lay life, you know. But the main obstacle is thinking that maybe you can do it, maybe you can't. It's a doubt. But if you just apply yourself, then you don't need to worry about results. Results come, you know. If you plant the seed, you get the fruit. It's very simple as that. Answer your question? Say that again.
Waiting for things and just not sort of chasing after things. That really touched me. So, do you do that now?
Yes.
Well, how do you do it? Because obviously doubt is obviously a theme. It's come up in other people's questions. But the problem there is obviously doubt while you're waiting. Doubt in the process. Doubt that the right thing to do. And in lay life, I think it's a real problem. You know, you may have better conditions here for doing it.
I'm
just wondering about any advice or, you know, lay life
waiting. Waiting? Well, waiting doesn't mean you're passive, you know, necessarily. It's not a passive thing. Waiting is just, you know, not acting. You know, you can see the thought in your mind that says, I want to do this, oh, I should do this, or maybe I should do that, or maybe I should go in psychic and find out, she can tell me, or he can tell me, or, you know. But then to start relaxing and trust, you know, and trust that the mind is an intelligence, there's intelligence, life force, intelligence, wisdom, you know, your mind is like a, it's a pool, you know, you have, you know, so by relaxing it, by becoming silent, relaxed, then you get new informations in your mind. And also, you know, these things happen also by the fact that we can, you know, also be surrounded by good friends. You know, people who encourage us, support us, you know, in the process of. So, you know, when I say waiting, it doesn't mean that I wait there and, you know, and sort of see what happens. I've seen people doing that, you know, using it as a practice. You see them in the middle of the room, they're just kind of looking, gazed, kind of in emptiness, you know. Or, you know, this one is waiting, or she's waiting. Get out of my way! You know. So it's not a question of, you know, it's a word, waiting. It's mean not acting on your on the impulses. That, just noticing the impulses that come up. Most of the impulses are fear motivated, you know, or impatience. They come out of impatience. They come out of fear. They come out of wanting to sort things out quick. You know, so the waiting has to do with being with all the things that can't wait. Do you understand? You know, when the thoughts are always kind of popping up. And so it's very difficult to explain paradoxes, you know. Like waiting is just observing all the things that are impatience. That all the things that are moving, you're not moving with them, in other words. So it has to do with mindfulness, awareness, being really fully present with that desire to solve things, you know, out of a sense of being rushed or fear or, you know, wanting to have a certainty about the future. This is what the waiting is about. not believing the thoughts that tell you that the future should be certain, clear, now. I should know. You know. So when I have difficulties myself, my waiting has to do with having the space in my mind not to believe my thoughts. Not to believe my emotions, my feelings, my, you know. I don't distrust them either. It's like I said to you in the first part, it's not that you have to be a nobody or somebody. It's a matter of observing when you become one and the other and noticing the difference. So, it's the same, you know, you notice when you're impatient and you notice when you're relaxed and at ease, the difference, you know. What works better for you? Some people are absolutely addicted, you know, to stress and adrenaline. They can't even stop because it's like a drug, you know, they can't. It's only by contrast they will know the difference, you know. But sometimes for most people, it's impossible. They're so frightened to stop and to observe and to watch rather than, you know, run with everything. Make some sense? Okay. Yeah?
I was brought up Roman Catholic, and I don't resonate very well with that religion. My question to you is, as a nobody, how do I exist with my family and friends that when I'm in their company, I just feel so dizzy all the time? Does that make sense to you? So as a layperson, how do I integrate my understanding of Buddhism with people who don't have that same understanding? I know, is this that the whole 2 hours have been about?
No, not at all. It's not a very common question, but it's not an uncommon one, you know. Do you try to convert them to Buddhism? Just checking, number one.
I oversalt the steak, you know, so they try and choke on it. Some ways
I try. Uh-huh.
I've tried to share some of the ideas.
Uh-huh.
A completely different planet, and I need therapy.
Uh-huh.
But I, you know, reject that. My doctor does. But generally speaking, the people around me, I find I'm a minority, and don't really know how I connect to and fit in.
Yeah. Do you, you know... Being a Buddhist is not about attaching to Buddhism, you know. Being a Buddhist is about befriending. So, you know, are you befriending your family or just showing them, I'm mindful now, are you? I know about impermanence, you know, all that God things, you know. That permanent God, is that really something that you believe in? You know, I can give you tons of advice about it. You know, I'm not short of advices on these things. But the first thing is for you, as a practicing Buddhist, let's say, you know, for you to observe the reaction you have towards them. You know, being mindful of your dizziness, that's one of the first step. Once you stop being dizzy, you might actually see them differently. But this is what you think. Can you hear yourself thinking?
Yes.
Can you? They are different. Opposite. Maybe they are. So what? What's the problem? Are we here to make a nice garden with lots of different flowers? Different trees? Well, it would be boring if we were all sort of daffodils, you know.
Should I keep trying to wake them up or just say, oh my God?
I mean, I'm a Buddhist nun. If I heard you like that, I'd start getting irritated instantly. I'm starting feeling stressed, you know. Leave them alone, those poor people, you know. Just leave them alone. Give them a break. You don't need anything. Just go to your room and meditate, then leave them alone. You're going to be a nuisance for them soon. No, you don't need to do anything, you know, just be yourself, be your kind self, practice the paramita, you know, metta, compassion, dana, generosity, sila, ethic, nekama, renunciation, Aditana, determination, and so on, Panya, wisdom. You do your work and you'll see the result of that in your family. Give yourself a year and come back to see me. You might have become a Roman Catholic, but... We had a friend, she's not here and you don't know her. She was traveling with one of our sisters and they were a very close friend, and she even paid for the sister's trip and they went east, you know. She's got a good sense of humor and she's a kind of quite sort of educated, quite sort of a critical type of mind, you know. And before they started, they already had a bit of an argument, you know, about how things are going to happen. And she made a joke about, I think by the time I come back, I might turn to Roman Catholicism. So do you understand what I'm saying? Don't try to change them, you know, watch your impatience, observe your impatience, and, you know, we seem different, you know, but listen, they're still human beings, they still feel, they still want to be loved, they still want to be appreciated, they still want to see you happy and contented, they still want to be able to talk to you in dialogue. I mean, that's the most important thing, you know, can you still dialogue with them, or just by becoming a Buddhist, suddenly you turn into this conceited brat? Not you, of course, no.
The thing is, you see the world so differently.
And what's the problem with that?
Nothing. I find it hard to talk to my mum sometimes.
I understand. I mean, I'm...
waving and dizziness, and, you know...
Well, maybe she's... Oh, God, leave her alone. Because, oh, you know, what about me if I do this to you? I mean, are you from Italian origin or something? No, are you Italian? Is your mom Italian?
Irish Hungarian.
How can you want your mother to be British? You know, kind of. You can't leave her alone, your poor mother. Why do you want her to be so kind of, what do you call this? You know. Like a Seri, a kind of Seri person, you know, sort of. I can't find a word right now. Standardized, you know, or sanitized, or whatever. Enjoy your mother, you know, waving her arms around. You're critical of your mother. You can see that? You're very critical of your mom. You're incredibly critical, in fact. So, this is what your next assignment is, that watch your critical mind. Just let your mother be. Can you do that? And tell her she's wonderful, just the way she is. Can you do that?
Yes.
There you go. I tell you, relationship with her will change drastically. She might turn to Buddhism at some point. You don't know. If you keep telling her how nice she is, you know, not how Buddhist she should become. And Buddhists, anyway, wave their hands around. And I've seen Buddhists, you know, kind of jumping up and down in the air, talking loud and singing and doing all kind of funny things. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's time and place, you know, it's always that. When and how and so on. But I understand, you want the peace that you have experienced in Buddhism, you want your family just to conform to that. Well, that's very selfish.
I feel they're missing out, though, you see. My perspective, I perceive that they are missing out. They haven't got the, you know...
How old are you?
38.
38? And you're still converting people? Oh my God, I thought you would have kind of called.
I see their longing and I see that they're missing. Yeah. It would be nice to even just go to
Do you know what?
Just to go and get them to the garden thing, just sit there and just be for 10 minutes and stop all that chitter chatter.
Yeah.
It's so different. And I find I can't find the right words to encourage them to just go and sit in the field and enjoy what they see.
Well, that's what you want to do, but they don't want to do that. So, how are you going to deal with that? That's a conundrum, isn't it? So I'm glad you express your frustration here with a group of sympathetic people. Fine, no problem, no problem. But you know, you cannot change anybody. That's what the Buddha said. You need to change yourself first. You know. That's why even monks and nuns, we would break our rules of monastic rules if we try to convert people. I mean, teach people who do not want to hear. It's one of our rules. You cannot do that. Because basically people cannot hear what they don't want to hear. You know, you can't force people. So I understand your frustration. I can hear you. I really understand how frustrating it is. But then you are a 38-year-old girl, and you can just lead your life as you wish. And when you are with your family, then you just have to accommodate them in your mind, you know. You can't just expect everybody to be like you, because that's demanding too much. It's frustrating for you. When they see you frustrated, you say, I wouldn't want to be a Buddhist. I mean, look at that. She's a massive frustration, this one. Why do you want to be a Buddhist, you know? She's always unhappy. She's always criticizing her. She's always telling her we should be quiet when we want to laugh and have a good cup of wine or something. We haven't gotten to that yet. The fact that you don't drink and they drink, maybe. No, we won't get into this today, but that could be another aggravation for you. So, critical mind, frustrated mind, wanting to convert. What was the next one? Anger. So you should bow to them, in fact, in your room. Just bow to them because they are the greatest teachers. They're showing you where you are at, you know. If you want to live with the monks and nuns, you know, I mean, nothing is just what you think, you know, in terms of having your way and having how, you know, you got German together with the French, with the English, with the Italian, with the Swedish, with the... It drives you mad sometimes. It drives you mad. When the German is talking, you know, and normally the English say, oh my God, what is she doing? Is she very angry? I say, no, she's just normal. She's just how you are in Germany. And when the French are just kind of expressing themselves relaxed and, you know, irreligious like we are, you know, she's just being rude, expressing all her feelings and so on. No, we're just normal. France, you're normal. And the British in France are not normal. And the French in France are not, and England are not normal. So we deal with that, you see. We have to deal with cross-cultural kind of traits. So you can have empathy for me now.
Could I make a comment, please?
Yeah.
About this religion, it's very important about religion.
Yeah.
It's very important because I'm a Buddhist. I have two... my brother-in-law is after the death of my sister, who became a monk. I have a neighbor who's a monk. And my wife is a Catholic, who's here. She has a lot of clergy in her family.
A lot of? Clergy. Yeah, clergy.
But we've gone on very well for the last 38 years. It has been no problem of anyone trying to come with the other. But there are lots of common platforms in both religions.
Of course. I mean, if I tell you that my closest friend is a Catholic nun, you know, she's my closest friend. Yeah, there's nothing, you know, once you start accepting people as they are, you just enjoy the way they are. It's quite fun to enjoy people the way they are. It's wonderful. The only thing that makes stop you from enjoying it is all the resistance we have that are caused by the ideas. We cling to how people should be. You cling to how they should think, how they should, you know. It's that clinging. And, you know, recognize that people are the way they are, and if you don't want to be with them, you have the choice to leave. At some point, you have your boundaries as well, you know? You don't have to be kind of walked over, all over, and then feel a victim. You don't have to be a victim of your family. You just enjoy them while they are there, and if you don't want them, you've got a choice to go. Don't you have the choice to leave when you want to? There you go. So, and then the more they see you friendly and so on, and the more they see how you change, how you become really compassionate and kind and patient, wow, you know, this Buddhism must be really something wonderful. That's how I nearly converted my father to Buddhism. He didn't quite get there. He said to me, he's got three daughters, both three of them on the spiritual path heavily and for the last 25 years. And he said, now I've become an agnostic. He's quite, you know, he's passed away now, but he's, you know, he tried to make a joke by using a very simple thing. He said, maybe yes, maybe no. But he only got drawn to Buddhism, or, you know, he noticed, for example, he was reading a book on anthropology written by somebody called Lévi-Strauss, and which famous anthropologist in France. And at the end of the book of this man, there was an eulogy on Buddhism, of Buddhism. And he was so impressed by this text that suddenly he got interested in the Buddhist teachings, you know, not as a Buddhist necessarily, but just, you know, the Buddhist teaching is not a religion per se, because it's a quantum leap from religion, because it stops you. It's not a question of belief or not believing, it's just noticing what is stopping you from being awake, from being awakened, from being, you know, being the truth kind of thing. You know, so it's just a very humble path about just noticing what blocks you from, you know, what is the layers of delusion that blocks you from seeing things as they are. So you can be a Catholic and Buddhist, a Jew and a Buddhist, and if you use a meditation, you can just use the teaching of Buddhism as a way of clearing the way for you, for your understanding. And in the midst of that, of course, you might lose your track and prefer to be a Buddhist than a Christian, you know. But if you explain to your family that when they ask that Buddhism is about kindness and peace and understanding, then say, oh, Christianity is the same thing. Catholicism is the same thing. But if you hang on to religion, I can often say I hate religion myself. Because in the name of religion, so many horrible things have been done, you know. Religion is what happens when it becomes institutionalized, you know. If you went back to the teachers, the early teachers of those movements, Christ or Buddha and so on, it would be very different, you know. Any more questions? Yeah?
Talking about formally being a dancer.
Yeah.
And how you came to the stage in your practice when you decided to make a path like that go. And then a lot of things started to happen, job opportunities. And you talked about that as a kind of energy. It gave you something to think of how energy worked. I'd like to ask you what you thought that energy was, or to say more about that.
Well, it's really, you know, I mean, energy is maybe a big word, you know, but it was more I was beginning to learn how to let go. You know, beginning of the day, at the end of the day, I could let go of the day. I could let go in my mind about the thing that worried me. I could let go about my tendency to want to know. You know, I began to see that all these thoughts were actually dominated by fear. The more I was letting go of my thought, the more I was letting go of my fears. And that came about through reading Krishnamurti, actually, who said in one of his teachings, thoughts are fear. And as I read this, it just struck a chord in me. I was ready to hear it, obviously, because then I began to really notice when I was thinking a lot and when I was not thinking. You know, it was really like an investigation process, a very small thing, you know. So this energy is really more the ability to drop the desire to know, to be certain, to have a certainty.
But that in itself seems to unlock something.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Yeah.
That's a very mysterious process, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, quite extraordinary process, yeah. Well, that's why we talk about faith, don't we? Faith is the ability to trust something you don't know yet. You know, the unknown. And Ajahn Sumedho used to teach us a lot, the capacity to stay to train the mind to stay conscious in the face of the unknown. It was like almost like a technique. He turned it almost into a technique. You know, it's like, for me, I turn it into a technique probably. You know, just saying, I want to know, but then you can't know. you know, and just stay with it. And then when I would not respond to the mind, then the thoughts will not necessarily stop. Do you know what I mean? But sometimes it might activate more the desire to want to know. Yes, but you know, it's not possible. You know. And then I would just let them go by just, you know, refraining from acting on them or believing them. Make sense? Yeah. So it's lifetime work, you can see, because thoughts are arising all the time, aren't they? But you know, in one talk like this, you can't explain everything, you know. You know, how are you going to live with your life without thinking? So, oh my God. Go to your boss and say, well, let me think while I'm just empty. And you're both, your boss stop kind of saying, you idiot, you know, I've just been saying something to you. Thoughts. So this is why the Noble Eightfold Path is there, to show you how to conventionally live. If you're going to be thinking, think about the thoughts that are going to bring more happiness in your life than misery. So thoughts that are founded in loving kindness, thoughts that are founded in generosity, thoughts that are founded in the paramitas of the mind, you know? Make sense? Having said that, you know, it's easy said, harder done, because this is maybe where the path is more difficult to be to understand the path, is that you don't cling to being a good person. You know, the path of goodness goes together with the ability to let go of unskillful thinking rather than suppress them, or believe, or judge them. See what I mean? So, in your everyday life, you can just notice, you know, what am I thinking right now? What am I feeling? And then, you know, it's you have free will. It's, you're not completely, you know, in a choiceless place. You can opt for one or the other, if you're mindful enough, of course. And if you have enough space between you and that thought, you know, if the desire is so strong that you get swept away, then you can't choose. Okay.